Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Lance Thurner. Today I'm going to be talking with Kate Irvin, Associate Professor of International Development Studies and Faculty Associate of the School of the Environment at St. Mary's University in Halifax. And I'll be talking to her about her new book, Carbon, out in 2018 by Polity Press. And Carbon is an excellent addition to our evolving efforts to understand clearly where we are and where we need to go in regards to climate change. With clear insight and deep experience in the field, Irvin describes how and why politics as usual has so far failed to prevent disaster and delves deep into the technological fixes that will and must be part of the human response to climate change. But ultimately, she argues, preventing full-scale disaster will require far more fundamental changes to global politics and economy. I am very pleased to be sharing my interview with her today, and I hope you enjoy it. Professor Kate Irvin, welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. And I'm very
pleased to have
you. Thanks for having me. So I'd like to start off this interview with just a little bit about your background and the path that eventually brought you to writing this book.
Yeah, there's, I guess one of the good places to start is what brought me to research that allowed me to start thinking about this question of carbon more broadly. And I would say that, you know, that goes back to a time when I was working on my PhD in political science, actually. And I was at York University in Ontario in Canada. And I was looking at biodiversity conservation globally and looking at global institutions that were involved in biodiversity conservation. And then kind of wanting to take it down to the local level on the ground where it was actually happening. And so for me, that was in Chiapas, Mexico. And so I spent a good chunk of time in Chiapas looking at a particular project called the Mexico-Mesoamerican Biological Corridor. And I was looking at the implementation of this biodiversity conservation project that was run through the Global Environment Facility, was being implemented by the World Bank. And one of the things that I was particularly interested in was what was a pretty clear disconnect between what was being said and what was happening at the global level versus what was happening locally in Chiapas. And so at the kind of international level, institutions treated biodiversity loss and its conservation as this, you know, you could basically have a universal blueprint that you could take anywhere in the world, any community, any nation, whatever it might be, and say, here's the projects that will protect your biodiversity. And I was also interested in the fact that these tend to be market-based projects. So the idea that if you create a market for biodiversity, then you're putting a value on it and we will then save it. So I was skeptical, I must admit, because Chiapas, Mexico, has a very long history of problems. In 1994, there was an indigenous uprising, problems around land distribution and the best land being held by the wealthy and the elite. And so the problems ran very deep, but the project wasn't addressing any of that deep political history that led to you know, land being cleared in the rainforest and why people might be going in and claiming that land. And in fact, the government encouraged people to go in to claim the land in the Lacandon jungle because they didn't want to deal with land reform. But there's also resource extraction and various other things going on. So I was interested in looking at, okay, what's actually happening on the ground? And it turned out there wasn't really much happening on the ground because of this big disconnect where local people were saying, no, no, we want to deal with the land issue before we deal with biodiversity. So things were pretty rocky. And I was interested in this question of participation, how groups were participating in the project, because it was supposed to be highly participatory, but we didn't see much of that happening. So long story short, while I was there doing that research, there were some communities that were beginning to participate in carbon forestry, which has kind of gained in popularity, but still, you know, I would say most people don't know much about it. But this, you know, idea that trees sequester carbon. So if you plant trees, you can sequester carbon. And what would then happen with these projects is that you'd have to calculate how much carbon was going to be stored in those trees. And then they could be awarded, or the communities that were participating or the actors participating would be awarded carbon credits or carbon offsets. And what this would allow for was countries or companies in the global north in particular, rather than reducing their carbon emissions at the source, they could buy these carbon offsets from a community in Mexico or other places that planted some trees. And increasingly now we're seeing the idea that you don't cut your trees, so maintaining trees as well, but it's still a very controversial kind of project. But basically the idea is that these communities could then sell carbon offsets to emitters who could, instead of actually lowering their emissions, they could say, look, we lowered our emissions, but they did it through buying these offsets. So, you know, there's a problem there, which I can talk more about, you know, as we go on. But I was curious, and I wasn't doing research on these projects, but I was interested in what was going on. And so I started looking at, okay, well, what's this global carbon market thing that's happening? And I became increasingly interested because what I saw was that the price of carbon in global markets, and predominantly at that time, it was in the European Union Emissions Trading System, which is the largest carbon market in the world, and also in the Clean Development Mechanism, which is a global offsetting mechanism that was developed under the Kyoto Protocol that allowed countries in the global south to create offsets to sell to Kyoto countries that had compliance targets. And so I was wondering what was going on because the price of carbon started to drop on the international market and quite a bit. And so at that time for me, I was especially interested in questions around, well, what does it mean for local communities that have been told, you know, hey, look, here's a development project. You're going to earn a lot of money by, you know, planting trees or whatever it might be, which also comes with risks or problems because it means you can't use your trees or your resources the way you normally have as a community. But when that price crashes, well, what does that mean for the community that's suddenly not getting the money that they were told that they would get? So that then led me to start to look in more detail at the global carbon market and say, okay, what is this thing? Why has it been developed? And why is the price crashing, and how effective is that for dealing with climate change if we have really volatile low prices when the whole point is to make it expensive? So I, about 10 years ago, I got involved in a research project around studying carbon markets globally and looking at their development in different jurisdictions around the world. And looking for me, rather than it being kind of a technical, okay, how is it designed? What does it look like? I'm interested in the politics around, you know, well, why does a government or why do, you know, global institutions choose carbon trading versus other strategies that might do better? So what are the interests there? And how effective is it? And why do they get designed in a way that makes them pretty ineffectual, that doesn't do what we're told they're supposed to do? So that project, you know, has been going on for about 10 years now. And so then where the book fits in is that it's part of Polity Press's resources series. So they, you know, they've got a whole host of different kinds of resources that people have written about, coffee, water, oil, coal, diamonds. And so I decided to do the, you know, to submit a proposal for the carbon book to really start thinking about these bigger questions around carbon as a resource. So the book itself goes beyond carbon trading in that specific project I've been doing to kind of explore the bigger picture about carbon. And then I would say, you know, part of the background that I also, you know, is interesting for me. And I actually in the first chapter start the book off with the fact that, you know, my own background, I come from an industrial town where, you know, when I was a university student, I worked at General Motors for 3 summers working on the line. And my dad had worked there. And, you know, it was very good unionized work and the pay was really good to pay for university. And then as a graduate student, I worked in a steel mill for 2 years working within the mill. And again, very good pay, and it helped me to pay for my graduate studies. And so it's an interesting thing, I think, to reflect upon the fact that we as individuals are kind of deeply involved and ensnared in a system that, you know, these are two of the most carbon intensive industries in the world, vehicle manufacturing and steel. And, you know, I needed to pay for school and my family needed to pay to feed us and to clothe us. And so it's not which, you know, many people will know this, but at the same time, it's a very complicated problem we're talking about because our lives are deeply wrapped up in the system we've created that is one that is just dripping with carbon. So that's kind of where the background that brought me to the book.
Yeah. Well, that's a great introduction. So, you know, I really enjoyed this book. It's very readable. And one of the things that's very useful about it is the great overview it gives both of kind of the technical side of global warming, but also the history of the politics of it, you know, since before Kyoto Protocol. And I can really imagine using this in an undergraduate classroom or something like that to give students a great overview of that. Is that the use you were imagining for this book, or what kind of audience did you have in mind?
Yeah, well, that's certainly one of them. You know, the publisher itself, they want these books to be more broadly accessible than a kind of narrow academic book that might only appeal to people who are really kind of immersed in a specific theory or approach or issue. And so I wanted to write the book so that it could, so that its reach could be, you know, go beyond academia, but at the same time, so thinking about academic targets, absolutely, like undergraduate students. And, you know, I see it as a great kind of introduction for students in the social sciences too, to think about, you know, here's some of the science issues or the science behind climate change, although it's science light. I'm not a physical scientist, obviously. But here's kind of what the problem is, what we need to understand. And then we can get into what we as social scientists do and think about the whys and the hows. But then also, you know, I've talked to some people who teach science classes saying, well, this is great for my students because it introduces them to the political questions around climate change and why it's been so hard to actually deal with this thing. But beyond that, I wanted there to be appeal so that, you know, people outside of the academic world could also pick it up and read it. And it wasn't going to be too technical or too theoretical so that they could actually, you know, engage with the questions of carbon and the issues of carbon and the politics of carbon in a way that might be useful for them in their own lives.
Great. Thanks for that. So one of the things I really enjoyed in this book was tracing the development of the idea of climate justice as it's changed and as the political dynamics of climate change have has changed, and as climate change has really entered the mainstream of political discourse, how do you see this idea as really developing over the last, I suppose it's 30 years now?
Right, around climate justice and environmental justice?
Yes.
It's an important one because I think too many of our discussions around problems like climate change still don't come to terms with the question of justice, and justice isn't at the heart of that discussion. And so, you know, the early environmental justice movement, really looking at communities of, you know, marginalized populations, looking at the racial aspect of environmental harm, and that, you know, recognizing that minority communities are impacted to a much greater extent because they tend to be living closer to toxic hotspots and all of the places that are more heavily polluted. And there's a real politics around that. And then, you know, thinking about climate change and borrowing from those insights around environmental justice that we've seen from movements, but also the academic literature, people are beginning to really apply the ideas in terms of climate change, because there's so many different angles we can look at, whether it's historically to say that the injustice of, you know, it's somewhat simple to just say North versus South, because I think it's a bit more complicated than that. And I think that's rooted in class relations and everything else. But to look at the historical inequity and historical responsibility and who's done most of the emitting historically, and to say that, you know, by all rights, it's those that have done the least that should have the right to the remaining carbon space. Politics doesn't allow for that, but that's a reality. And then on the other hand, the impacts that we're starting to see around the world from climate change, it's the poorest and the most vulnerable in communities of color that are being more heavily impacted in the here and now. And it doesn't mean, and so I talk about this idea that, you know, many people say climate change is the great equalizer because we're all going to experience it. And that's true to a certain extent, but at the same time, it's more vulnerable communities that won't have insurance, that don't have access to the resources to weather the storm, that won't have the money to buy the food when their crops fail. And so it really has this significant class and race and gender and many more, you know, lines of oppression. That component is really significant. And so I think those, you know, ideas that came from the environmental justice movement are now, you know, being used to talk about climate justice and to say that, you know, this whole thing is about massive levels of injustice. And we have to take great care to make sure that our solutions don't replicate the injustices, because that's another aspect of it. If we're going to have policies that simply replicate injustices and that don't help those that are being hurt the most, then I don't want to pursue those ones. I think we need to, you know, look for better models. And I think, you know, following things like the Green New Deal debates that are happening right now in the U.S., well, I mean, that really tries to put, you know, environmental justice and climate justice within the policy proposals. And so I think that, you know, the idea, its time has come, and more people recognize that.
Yeah. You know, in the bigger international scene, the idea of climate justice does often get put in this dualism of the global South and the global North. Do you see that as an idea that's still useful and is going to stick around? Or do you think that we're going to see different ways of looking at the global dynamics of climate justice?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a certain inevitability that we will continue to use the North-South distinction in terms of talking about climate change because of the historical responsibility, I would say, of the countries, the advanced capitalist developed countries that have benefited from carbon intensive development to a much greater extent. And so I think that's inevitable in terms of that divide. And I think that it's also inevitable just in terms of if we look at the Conference of the Parties that just took place in Poland in December, you know, many were saying after the Paris Agreement in 2015 that the differentiation between North and South, while it obviously didn't disappear, the Paris Agreement was doing away with, to a significant extent, that divide. And yet what we saw in this past round of negotiations where they were supposed to finalize the Paris rulebook, that divide was one of the main issues and sticking points, because countries in the global South, and I think justifiably so, now there's distinctions, of course. So does China, you know, is China the same as Guatemala? Clearly not. But countries negotiating as a bloc from the global South continue to point to the fact that countries in the global North have not taken on their historical responsibility. They have not lowered their emissions consistent with what the science is telling us. They're not providing climate finance anywhere near what is required to help countries in the global South develop differently. And so many of them say, look, you're not willing to walk the walk. The problem originated with your development model. And therefore, unless you actually provide sufficient finance and show us that you're willing to undertake the changes that are required, how can you tell us we must do it differently? So I think that's just an inevitability that we can't get away from. I think at the same time, increasingly many are recognizing that, you know, in terms of climate justice and injustices, we can also look to communities in the global North that are marginalized, that are bearing a much greater impact from climate disasters and from climate change. And so I think there's also that kind of looking at the different kind of vectors of oppression, whereby we say that this is also about, and I think, you know, things like Occupy Wall Street and the discourse around the 1% that emerged, and every year Oxfam releases a report, its report talking about the wealth inequalities in the world. And I think that discourse helps to kind of change things, to recognize that the 1%, you know, broadly speaking, they're present in every country around the world. And you also have people everywhere around the world who are suffering. And so that allows us to also appreciate that a simple North-South divide isn't always helpful, even though there's aspects of it that remain very relevant.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a good way to get to the next question, or the next issue I want to ask you about. So, because this, you know, the internal diversity of these nations really brings into mm-hmm. question whether or not, you know, nations are the right political entities to be mediating our reactions to climate change. Yeah. And of course, the U.S.'s, you know, recent pullout from the Paris Protocol really brings into question whether or not national governments are up to the challenge at all, or whether they even have the tools to really adequately respond to climate change. And so I'm wondering a little bit both about your thoughts on that question, but also where else we're seeing, you know, meaningful action on climate change.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, it's such an important question, because this problem is so big and so pervasive that, you know, how do you deal with it effectively? And I think many, you know, especially there's a whole scholarly literature around the fact that climate action is happening at many different levels. It's not just the nation state anymore. And so you see non-state actors, or you see subnational actors. So, you know, people often point to, you know, California, what it's doing against the tide of Trump's anti-climate change, anti-environmental kind of approach. And so from my own perspective, I mean, you know, and I've thought a lot about like, what is the nation state and what is government or what should it be? And there's a big divide, or, you know, separating out what we want it to be and what it should be versus what it is, I think is one of the important starting points. And I think I try to underscore this in the book as well. I mean, if we look to Canada right now, where I am, you know, there's huge debates and protest and controversy around pipelines. And these pipelines are dealing predominantly with extracting tar sands oil out of Alberta to then be, you know, shipped to various markets, including markets in Asia. And one of the big arguments is that, you know, in Alberta, they're landlocked, they need the pipelines. But then the science is quite clear on the fact that tar sands oil, given its significant carbon intensity relative to other kinds of oil, it can't be extracted. That doesn't mean it's not going to be, but, and so we have this huge problem, and I'm actually very sympathetic with the workers in that sector, which also gets into this just transition question. But at the same time, you know, like if we see, you know, I was reading this morning about this research that's now been published on clouds disappearing, and that may lead to such extreme levels of warming that we will have massive die-off across the planet. Now that's down the road, obviously, but this is where we could be headed. We have to take it seriously. And yet our government, because there was lots of controversy and then the project was put on hold, Kinder Morgan, the company, with one of the pipelines, and then the Trans Mountain pipeline, or with that pipeline, they basically decided they weren't going to necessarily continue with it. Long and the short of it is the Canadian government bought the pipeline. And this is a government that goes around the world calling itself a climate leader. They bought the pipeline and now they're saying it's going to go through. We are going to build it. And so I think we have to understand that our states, because of the model of economic growth that we have, and capitalist economic growth requires continued growth and continued profitability. And if you live in countries or places that are relying on carbon-intensive growth and development, then governments are necessarily going to see how they can continue to facilitate that, even though we're confronted with this existential crisis. And so I would say that, unfortunately, our governments in many ways have been captured by whether it's fossil fuel interests or the interests of those that benefit from business as usual. And I think Trump is an extreme case where we're seeing, you know, Rex Tillerson being appointed to like high level positions and those in the coal sector being, you know, appointed. And so that's not the state I want to have, but that's a reality of the state. At the same time, I think that who is able to undertake the kind of massive scale action that's required, well, that is governments. That is the nation state. They're the ones who have access to the resources. They're the ones that can make the laws, that can provide the incentives to do the things that have to be done. But that then requires the political mobilization from people to say, we're demanding something different. And that's one of the big challenges because we don't all agree. Not everyone is on board with the project of voting in, you know, true climate leaders. And so it's a very difficult reality. And I think the reality is, too, that our governments depend on the revenue that comes from economic growth, which is dripping with carbon. So what we're starting to see, and a lot of people are kind of feeling really fed up with waiting. And so it's very interesting to watch these movements now around the world in terms of, you know, say the Extinction Rebellion or the students that are striking every Friday in Europe and now Australia and other places, and the Sunrise Movement in the United States. And we have a youth rising movement here in Canada. And so it's very interesting to watch a lot of the young people beginning to mobilize to say, this is the planet that you're leaving us, and therefore it's time we mobilize. So that's one place where it's political mobilization. I would say that, you know, there is hope in that mobilization because they're putting pressure on governments. But I think that, you know, that's going to be one of the big challenges, to change our political systems.
Yeah, and it might be an interesting fallout of this current populist wave, the way that the new way that climate politics are being politicized, instead of being treated as a you know, common issue, a universal issue, an issue that should not be politicized, which is what we mostly saw in the decades leading up to now. Now, with this,
well, I always found it interesting. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I always found it interesting that with Al Gore, you know, he said that, you know, climate change was not a political issue; it was a moral issue. And I always thought that was, you know, problematic to frame it that way, because yes, it's a moral issue, but it's immensely political. But you know, Al Gore, I think he's done a lot, and so I don't want to take that away from him in terms of bringing attention to the problem. But he's also somebody who has these very fairly status quo technical solutions that tend to reinforce power relations as they are now, rather than requiring fundamental change.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, whenever someone says it's a moral issue, it's not political, I kind of cringe and say, no, it's primarily political.
Yeah. Well, let's go right to that then. I mean, so I think it's a common reaction amongst many people who are terrified of climate change, but don't really know what to do and just kind of hope things get better, to put at least a little faith in the technocrats of the world and the Elon Musks of the world to come up with something. And so many of these projects are really, you know, intended to require as little social change as possible. Do you think that society is going to have to change in order to really match up with this challenge?
Yeah, well, I mean, if, you know, so in October, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released their special report comparing 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming to 2 degrees Celsius of warming. And it gets cited very widely now, with people noting the fact that they basically said we've got about 12 years at the time that it was published to dramatically, fundamentally change the way we're doing things and to get our emissions down dramatically if we have any hope of staying below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming. And, you know, they were using words like unprecedented in terms of the kind of change that's required. And ultimately, the reality is the kind of change we're talking about is unprecedented, and it's massive, and it's widespread, and it's across all of our systems and structures, and that's just the reality of it, because carbon is so ubiquitous in every aspect of our lives. And so this is the challenge, and for me, you know, talk about it a lot in the book. That kind of change, that kind of sweeping change, is running up headlong into the vested interests that have that benefit from the status quo, or from, you know, we'll do a tweak here, we'll change a few little things here, but we're fundamentally not going to change the fact that, you know, we have an economic system that requires continual growth on a limited planet. Nobody wants to truly talk about that in the halls of power, because of the implications of that. You know, what do you do if you say we're not going to grow anymore? And there's very significant, powerful interests as well that want to keep things the same because they profit heavily from a fossil fueled world. So the fossil fuel industry is the most powerful in human history, with outrageous amounts of wealth and power at their disposal. And so, you know, for the past number of years, I've been attending a lot of different meetings where you find government officials and policymakers, and you find lots of fossil fuel representatives. And they're all very comfortable together talking about how can we do this? And yet the same fossil fuel representatives will tell you, well, no, we can't do it as quickly as they say it's going to need to happen. So we're going to have to take a slow approach. And fundamentally, their model is one that is based on continuing to burn fossil fuels. And so in that sense, that's where I am not so hopeful, because the nature of the system that we've constructed, what it requires, and the very powerful interests that, you know, I think it's very interesting right now in Canada watching what's happening in the US around people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because she's kind of shining a light on what is essentially a corrupt political system now, where the rich have basically bought their politicians and they can get them to do whatever they want, whether it's in the common good or not. And typically it's to ensure that they continue to profit. So the question for me is, given the sweeping change, the fundamentally deep change that's required, how are we going to change our politics? And that's where I think political mobilization is required, because I don't think, you know, Elon Musk has an incentive to keep us driving. Let's, you know, we can make it electric, but we're still going to build all of those cars and continue to build more roads and to have everyone in vehicles. And setting a preference for the individual car over investing in really good, effective public transportation, for example. And, you know, my preference is to see these, and I talk about it in the book, coming from another scholar, Daniel Aldana Cohen, and he talks about democratic ecologies versus luxury ecologies. And luxury ecologies are these kinds of, you know, approaches to climate change or environmental problems that tend to benefit the elite and professional classes, rather than being universal and being accessible to all. And so democratic ecologies are about saying, let's invest in strategies that everybody can benefit from and that kind of change the landscape of how we do things. So the question is one of the politics of getting there then.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I want to make sure to ask you about before we're done today is the carbon markets, as you've studied so much and write about in this book. You know, we've had almost 20 years of experience now with carbon markets. What do you think is the lessons we can take from this? And are they going to be a part of the movement going forward?
Yeah. So will they be a part of the movement going forward? I would say that under the current kind of configuration of our political systems, well, yes. You know, The Paris Agreement, Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, includes the architecture. It's not detailed at the moment, and that's one of the sticking points that wasn't resolved at the last conference of the parties. But it lays out a framework to allow for international carbon trading. And then we see it happening, you know, with the EU. We see it in California. We see it in Quebec, here in Canada, in Nova Scotia, my home province. They've just introduced a cap and trade scheme. And then China and South Korea and, you know, Mexico's getting ready. So we're seeing their proliferation around the world. Now, what we've seen with carbon markets is that there's a big interest in them, and I would say is because they require the least pain. So, you know, and this is why fossil fuel companies are lobbying for them versus regulation, for example. And so the lessons we can take from them so far, if you look at the carbon markets that have been up and running, you know, UN carbon offsetting, like they began in the earlier 2000s, 2005, the European Union emissions trading system began, and then we've seen more and more coming on board. Nowhere in not one carbon market anywhere in the world have we seen a price anywhere near what we're told is required to incentivize a deep change in behavior so that you get that kind of change to a lower zero carbon, you know, alternative. And so my research has shown that the reason we're not getting the high prices is because they're designed that way. Governments design them in a way that they often set the caps too high, so there's more room within it to allow for more emissions. They give allowances away for free to initially usually most of the emitters and then to heavy emitters. And they allow for carbon offsets, which basically inflates caps even further. Why do they do all this? Because it means that it's not stringent. If you have too many carbon allowances available in a carbon market, then you've got an oversupply, meaning the price will be low. So this is political. You know, it's political motivations that see them designed that way. Now, I also take issue with economists who say carbon markets are the best and most efficient and cost-effective way for dealing with emissions because it lets the market decide where it's best to lower emissions. And then they get frustrated because governments, you know, aren't letting markets operate the way that they should. And I would argue that these economists, they refuse to come to terms with reality. They tell us that what's in the textbook will somehow translate into a reality that doesn't exist anywhere. Markets are always political. There's no such thing as the free market. There never has been, except in our theories. And the sooner we recognize this, the sooner we can at least be honest about what's going on here. So I think they're going to continue, but they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing from a climate change standpoint. And I also have concerns about what's required, because fundamentally it's about making carbon into a commodity. And once you do that and you're putting a price on it, those that can afford to emit can continue to do so. And so you get that inequality and that injustice again baked into it, because it allows those with the resources to continue with business as usual while others are paying the price. And then going back to my example from the beginning of our discussion, looking at poor communities in Mexico who suddenly their trees have been commodified. And so there's this interesting documentary that was produced by PBS actually called The Money Tree. And they look at Brazil and a number of carbon offsetting schemes for General Motors and American Electric to deal with emissions in the US. This is all part of a voluntary carbon market scheme. To deal with their emissions by doing carbon forestry in Brazil. And, you know, they show interesting examples of the poor member of a community who cuts down a tree to repair a roof, who then gets arrested. But GM and American Electric can continue with business as usual. And the poor resource user who is having no impact on global climate change and didn't contribute to it in any way is now being arrested for drawing on a resource that's required to maintain a livelihood. And so there's an injustice there that we don't talk enough about as well when we put a price on carbon and make it an exclusive right, because we're giving those rights to those who can afford it. And so I don't want to boil the world down to one giant market where we just commodify everything and we go according to the logic of whoever's got the resources can buy the right to do what they want to do, and, you know, everyone else can fend for themselves. So yeah, I think we're going to see that project continue, but they're not doing what we need them to do from an environmental standpoint or a social or ecological justice standpoint.
Well, before we run out of time, is there anything about this book that we haven't covered that you want to make sure is here in the interview?
I think, you know, we've talked about a lot of it, but I think, you know, for me, one of the main goals of the book was to kind of challenge the idea that we can continue along with business as usual, and we can continue talking about economic growth as though there isn't a problem there, and we can figure it all out. And I wanted to kind of provide that history to show that, you know, we have to honestly talk about our economic system and what it requires with growth and profitability. And we have to talk about how that economic system and its power relations are then really kind of shaping the so-called solutions that we're seeing being developed around the world now in many cases. And especially things like natural gas, we see, you know, many political actors and powerful actors will talk about it as a bridge fuel. It's this great thing that will get us to a low carbon future. And I would turn around and say, this is a fossil fuel. We should be going with renewables that are zero carbon, not building infrastructure that will lock in more carbon emissions for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And we often don't talk about the methane that actually gets released as part of the natural gas process of extraction and production, and which often makes it worse in terms of climate change, because methane is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon. It just stays, its life in the atmosphere is shorter. So I want us to be able to think critically about the solutions that are on offer, so that we can actually begin to think about climate change as the political problem it is, and not act as individual consumers, but to start to see ourselves as political citizens who should be thinking about the politics of this and how we can act collectively to pressure governments to change what it is that they're doing.
Well, that was really well said. Well, thank you so much for this interview. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm continuing, you know, to do the work on carbon markets. And so I'm actually working on a paper right now that, you know, in writing the book, I these ideas, I was thinking about them. And so I'm doing it in greater detail now. But I'm thinking about this question of carbon markets and expert knowledge. And when I say expert knowledge, you know, I want to kind of problematize the idea of expert knowledge. So what makes an expert in terms of those that speak in favor of carbon markets? And we find that often the expert is, you know, the technocrat, policymakers with an interest in, you know, kind of minimizing the impact of climate change. It's the fossil fuel companies, it's the trade associations, the industrials. They become the ones who can speak about carbon markets and provide the expert knowledge on carbon markets. And then the markets themselves are so complicated. Very few people, you know, are actually immersed in what it takes to make a carbon market. And how complicated that actually is. And I would argue that given the complexity and the kind of difficulty in understanding what these things are, it closes off opportunities for well-informed democratic debate on whether these are the strategies we should actually be pursuing. And so I'm exploring these themes around, you know, the complexity and what goes into creating these markets that very few people understand. And then who gets to have the authority to speak on behalf of these markets. And I mean authority whereby those in power actually listen to them. Because if you're a critic, they don't want to hear it. But, you know, if you're the right kind of person in the right position of power, everybody wants to listen to you. So I think it's time to have a discussion about, you know, those knowledge-making processes that are going into carbon markets as well, and how they kind of fetishize carbon in a way that it becomes really difficult to understand. And that's not what we need either. So trying to democratize the debate.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait for that work to come out. I mean, this is, it sounds incredibly fascinating. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me today, and I look forward to seeing your work.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.